A lot of people have asked me to discuss this topic, and so we're going to take a little bit of time to go through what I can discover about angels, demons, and Satan. You have an outline that was prepared by a friend of mine, Brent Virgil. He's a short tail relative.
He's your nephew-in-law.
My nephew-in-law, okay? I have to rely on Tim to explain what a nephew-in-law is. But
and his wife was Mandy's college roommate.
Okay, that close. Works. That's even closer. That establishes a relationship, I suppose. I felt like the material that Brent put together is instructive and will... he calls it a self-study guide. He put it together for people to use in their own study. And so we're going to kind of change that a little bit, and we're going to use it for this study this evening. It'll probably take us several weeks to get through this material, but I think it's worthwhile. There isn't a lot of information about angels in the biblical record. There's even less information about demons. There's some information about Satan. We know some basic things about Satan. But because there's not a lot of information, it's tempting to want to kind of fill in the blanks that we see in the biblical information. We're going to try to avoid that. We'll try to the best of our ability to stay with the biblical information, and I know that there will be questions that are left unanswered, but that's just the way that it is. It's tempting, as I say, to try to fill in the blanks, but we're going to try to avoid that as much as we can. So Brent, in his study, Brent says or suggests that the place to begin is with definitions. And that's the place where I always try to begin when I study something, is I try to look at the definitions of the words that are used to represent the idea that we're trying to study. So tonight we're going to look at definitions. And I realize that some of this is material that you wouldn't have access to. Some of it is material that everybody is familiar with, but we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about this. Angels, of course, appear in both the Old and the New Testament. And because they appear in the Hebrew scriptures and in the Greek scriptures, there are two different words that are used to represent the idea of angels. In the Old Testament, they picked up a word from the old Hebrew language, the what's called the ancient Hebrew, which in some cases was not written with letters like we're familiar with, but rather it was done with pictographs. So in some senses, the ancient Hebrew resembles the hieroglyphics that we're familiar with from old Egypt. That's not terribly surprising because of the relationship between Egypt and Israel. But we're going to look at some information from the ancient Hebrew. And again, I say this is information that's a little bit hard to find. This might not be something that you would have access to. But he talks about, the lexicographer talks about the basic pentagraph or the basic non-letter description of an angel. And it's this image right here. It turns out that that's the image that is a combination of a hand, and you can kind of see that in the first part of the image, and then a shepherd's staff. And the shepherd staff is a little hard to picture because it's upside down. When you see that image, you have to turn it over so that it looks like what we think of as being a shepherd's staff. When those are combined, the hand and the shepherd's staff, the cane that he would use, it's, he says that it represents a staff in the palm. Now, that's kind of interesting. A person who was a nomad, and that's what the ancient Israelites were, they traveled from here to there and all over. They would travel on foot with a staff in their hand, and that staff that they carried provided support in walking, so it was like a cane, as well as being a weapon against predators. And it was also, I might point out, because it belonged to a shepherd, what they would use to tend to their sheep. That staff, that shepherd's crook, meant that they could pick up sheep, they could control them, they could move them in different ways. In fact, I have seen suggestions that when they counted their sheep, they would hold out the staff. And as the sheep passed underneath of the staff, that was an easy way for them to count their sheep and make observations about them. Talking to Sharon about shepherds and sheep and taking care of sheep. And she was telling me that when they vaccinate the sheep, they dab a little bit of color onto the sheep. And that tells them that they've already vaccinated that sheep. It's harmless. It washes out after a little while. But that's the way that they kept track of their sheep. So shepherds would use this staff for a lot of different reasons. Some we can normally assume they use it like a walking cane. They used it as a weapon. And they used it to control their sheep. So then he says, beyond that, this pictograph, the hand and the staff, was sometimes seen with another pictograph in between the two. And he says, that is a messenger, or somebody who walks for another. So I don't know exactly how to describe that, but I think that's an important idea as we look at the development of angels. An angel might be someone who walks for another. Not necessarily the person that wields the staff or the person who is the one who is in charge, but he walks for another, maybe an under shepherd or someone that would help him. In the Hebrew, this was something that became an angel or a messenger or an ambassador. And in the written form of Hebrew, it looked something like this. I don't know what all of those slashes and dots mean, but it is the messenger or an ambassador. And in the ancient Hebrew, they say that this is the word that is commonly thought of as morphing into what we have in the Hebrew written language in letters as the Hebrew word number 4397. That's the numbering system that Strong used to apply to this. It also is sometimes found with more things in between the palm and the staff And sometimes some things added on both ends of it. And he says sometimes it became the message that they were delivering. That's not typically the way that we perceive an angel as being the message. We tend to think of angels as being a personage. And he says it also kind of morphed into the idea of a message that came through action. And he says that it would have reference to work or business or workmanship or goods or cattle or stuff or a thing. So you have the palm and the shepherd's staff. And then you have the ambassador of the one who held the shepherd's staff in his palm. And then it kind of morphed into the idea of a message that was sent. And then finally, it was characterized as a message that was sent through action. Now, you keep looking at this word and the ways that it changed. Sometimes it meant a journey. And you can see the form of the word up there. It's to walk a journey or lifestyle, or the customs that we follow. It was frequently in the writings of Nephal, Hephel, Pel, and it's a participle. I don't know any of those authors. I'm not familiar with their writings, but it's to walk, to go away or along, and it could even mean to go or to come. And this kind of word morphed into a little bit different idea of angel. Then it also is kind of built into the idea of paying someone to travel. But you see that basic pictograph, the hand and the staff, and then it came to mean something that you paid for traveling. It was a custom that you had to pay, and we're familiar with customs agents and how they collected taxes. Well, that's what it means when it's a custom. It's something that you would drop. I'm not sure exactly why that was there. And then there's a sense in which this is to walk up an incline or to step. So you're coming up. And again, maybe we see that developing in the idea of angel. It's a procession. It could be the walk of a company of people, not just one person, but a whole company of people or a group of people. And then finally, it's a place where they walk. Now, I'm not sure exactly how to understand that, but it is translated that way. Sometimes it appears that that's what this word or this pictograph would have reference to. Then the last bit of information that we can get about this hand and the staff is it's to come or to depart, to go away, to follow, to get, to lead, to bring, to carry. So there's a lot of different meanings that are associated with this pictograph in the ancient Hebrew. That's not a language that was in use when Moses wrote the Old Testament. Yeah.
Is it meaning angel in each instant?
I'm sorry?
Does it mean angel in each instant, but it's describing it in a different way?
Well, I don't know much about ancient Hebrew. I think it's different aspects of an angel. If the dictionaries and the lexicons that are put together to deal with the ancient language are like what dealt with the language that I'm more familiar with, then I would say that it's different aspects. And in our language, we would show that with different endings on the basic word, like work and working. They would do it by adding parts to a pictograph. So I'm not enough of an ancient language scholar to be able to comment on that. But I just passed this information along. I think basically what we can say is that it's a messenger who is working on behalf of someone else generally. Could be the person himself who is the messenger, but generally we think of it as being someone who's working for someone else. So, questions, comments.
Yeah.
Just remember this hand staff. That's the basic word. Yeah, Bill.
Well, you said this was not in use when Moses was in the picture, but the nation of Israel started out with Jacob's family in Egypt. And grew into this huge group of people over 400 years. So wasn't that the language that they had then, since that was the beginning of the nation?
It probably was. And it was largely patterned after Egypt, where they found themselves in captivity.
So wouldn't that have been in effect when Moses was there?
So it would predate Moses. By the time of Moses, they had a written language that was typically right here.
Yeah.
That's the written language that Moses would have used. Well, he wouldn't have used that language, but this is what the Old Hebrew kind of morphed into, because Old Hebrew didn't have the diacritical markings, and that's what these slashes are at the top. Those were not added until the Masoretic text was developed, and that was much later. But Moses wrote the Old Testament using this basic language right here. Yeah.
So it'd be more like when Abram was wandering in as a sojourner, and during that time period when he was with his wife and with Lot and in different countries, that would be the ancient time that you'd be talking about.
You know, I don't know. I think these two things existed side by side. The pictograph kind of language and the more familiar written kind of language kind of grew up side by side. And a lot of people would suggest that the way that these things develop, each of these letters in the written language tended to correspond to a part of the pictograph. And, you know, it takes more expertise than I have to be able to see the correspondence between those. Yeah, Bill.
Now, if I understand what I've read, Moses was an Amorite, Abraham was an Amorite.
Yes, he was.
And they had their own language, and that was what he would have passed on to his descendants, and their own form of writing. And what was that, you know?
Don't know.
It's completely
Don't
different than this.
know. I've seen analyses of that, and it's just beyond my skill set to know how to interpret those the development of those languages. I wish I could. It's a fascinating study. If you ever get a chance to look at that, it really is fascinating to look at the development of the Hebrew language against the backdrop of Egyptian hieroglyphics.
When I was as the senior in high school, I think our teacher, our textbook had from the ancient English or Gaelic language, how it evolved into what we speak today. And she could actually read the old unintelligible stuff as it was supposed to be spoken.
Yeah,
And it's mind-boggling.
it's a
How do we make it
fascinating
sound out of those
it's a
words?
fascinating study. It's just it demands more imagination than I have to be able to kind of see the pictures, the pictographs, and understand them. I just can't. Like the palm and the staff, it doesn't make sense to me that the staff is upside down. Of course, maybe I don't understand how a shepherd carries a staff. Maybe they carry it with the hook down because they would use it to pick up sheep. I know that they did that. But my experience with a staff, you carried it with the hook up. So just more imagination than I can muster. I'm a little too analytical to get into that kind of a study. Okay, so let's get to some things that are a little bit more familiar to us. Brown Driver Briggs is in essence, the kind of the gold standard for defining Hebrew terms. Now, Strong and others have defined them, but Brown Driver Briggs is the gold standard for defining Hebrew words. And this is what they say, that this word, 4397, is a messenger or a representative. And we kind of saw that when we were looking at the pictograph. Sometimes it's used as theophanic or theophanic. I'm not sure how to pronounce that word. Theophanic angel. And when we talk about something being theophanic, that's something that appears as a representative of God. Okay? Yeah. As a representation of God, excuse me.
I think you and I spoke about this once. There are a couple of incidents where the angel speaks as if he is God in his person. He's speaking
As God.
as and in first person, not in second person.
Right. The one that's usually used as a theophanic demonstration of God is the burning bush. God was in the burning bush. So that bush would have been serving the function of an angel. Okay? Again, that's kind of a little foreign to the way that we think of an angel, but if we're correct in understanding this, the burning bush, because it was a representation of God, could be thought of as an angel, a messenger. This is from a different lexicographer. He says it's a word that wasn't used very frequently. It refers to a messenger, an ambassador. It's sometimes translated as ambassador, sometimes as angel. 101 times this is translated as angel in the King James translation. Angels, messenger, or messengers, plural. Most of the time it's translated as angel. And from the number of times that this word is used in the Old Testament, you see how important angels are in the whole scheme of things with man and his relationship with God. Okay? Strong, again, says it's an unused root word, this 4397, and it comes from or means to send a deputy or a messenger, someone who is specifically from God, although it doesn't necessarily have to be from God. It could be from the person who is in charge. An angel could be a prophet, could be a priest, could be a teacher, used 213 times in the New Testament. And it was Strong that did the work to figure out how frequently these words appeared. So that's why you see this notation along with Strong. Mount says that it's one who is sent, a messenger, or an angel. It could be a person who is sent. We sometimes think of the word apostle as one who is sent, and that's really the root meaning of the word apostle. But churches apparently had angels, people that they sent to see John in Patmos. So you'll read in the beginning of the book of Revelation how John addresses the angel of the church in Ephesus. I don't think he's talking about a heavenly being there. I think what he's talking about is a person that Ephesus had sent to John to get this communication that John is giving to the church in Ephesus. Now, again, notice that we've changed now and we're talking about the Greek language. We're not talking about the Hebrew anymore. We're talking about the Greek language. Strong says that this word in the Greek is used 182 times. So if you combine that with the Hebrew, you have almost 400 times that this concept of messenger or angel appears in the corpus of the entire Old Testament plus New Testament. And if you count the Apocrypha, it's over 700 times. Yeah, Bill.
This is what you're talking about here. These literally human beings like you and me that were referred to as angels.
Yeah, the angel of the church in Ephesus would have been a messenger appointed by the church in Ephesus to go to the island of Patmos and receive the letter that John was writing to the church in Ephesus. And then he would take it back.
Now, this study we're about to do, are we going to be referring to these human angels or the divine angels?
You have to determine whether it's a human angel, a human messenger, or a divine messenger from the context.
So when Abraham met the three angels that destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, they looked like human beings, but somehow he knew they were angels.
Don't know how. But you're right. Angels or messengers, a theophanic appearance of God was often in a form that looked like a man.
But there were other incidents.
Yeah.
When Manoah and his wife met the angel.
Sure.
It was obvious who he was to them.
Sure. Balaam's donkey saw an angel.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know what it looked like, but he saw it. Okay. So it was a messenger. Yeah.
Ted said
something. Go ahead, Lee.
No,
yeah. Ted. Oh, Don.
Ted.
Yeah, all I said was the donkey saw an angel with a flaming sword. So,
yeah.
So I think more also about Jacob wrestling with an angel all night long.
Yeah.
So it was not just a spiritual being, but a physical being that he could have contact with. So.
Yeah. But again, I think just like the burning bush, that was a theophanic appearance of God in a different form. Okay. So the messenger could have been God himself appearing. It could have been someone that God sent on his behalf. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Like I said, there are still going to be a lot of gaps when we finish discussing this, but we have to restrict ourselves to the information that we have. And the best information that we have is that this is a messenger. Someone who is doing something. And it could be that the message that they were bringing was embodied in what they did. Remember, we saw that in the ancient language where it was a message that was conveyed by the work that they were doing. Okay. Thayer, again, this is our last aspect of the definitions. Thayer generally picks up how this word would have been used in secular Greek, as opposed to Strong, who focuses on basically biblical Greek. Thayer expands his look at biblical Greek and secular Greek, and Thayer says this word means a messenger or an envoy, one who is sent, an angel, and specifically could refer to a messenger from God. Although it doesn't necessarily have to be a messenger who came from God. Okay. Comments, thoughts? What's this lead you to think about angels? Yeah, Kim.
I guess, you know, back when you're looking at kind of hieroglyphics, or you're looking at what do they call them, pentagrams or
pentagraphs.
Pentagraph.
Not
yeah,
pentagram.
Right, pentagraph. The stamp in the hand or the staff in the palm and the support in walking and the weapon to defend against predators or thieves, and the care of the sheep seem to go away in the definition over time, because now it's whittled down, you know, obviously centuries later, whittled down to a messenger and an envoy. And the reason I'm kind of asking that is, you know, we hear a lot of people say, well, I had an angel with me, an angel was helping me, you know, an angel from God was sent to me and helps me through that time. And I've even used that terminology myself. I've said, you know, I felt like in my mother, in her passing, because her condition had deteriorated so quickly, I've said so many times, I feel like God sent an angel to take her at just the right time in her life. Well, that's probably a misnomer. That's not really the way angels work, I don't think. But we have that kind of in our cultural vocabulary. We talk like that. And so we do have cases in the New Testament where an angel was helped people, not just a messenger. So I'm wondering how that part of the definition has kind of dissipated over time, and is it still accurate? Is it accurate to say that I could have an angel walking with me, or an angel assisting me, or caring for me? So that, I mean, I'm hoping we'll answer that in this class. I'm not expecting an answer right now, but I'm just saying that somehow those definitions kind of got muddied a little bit, and now we're down to, in the New Testament, primarily being used to mean, because even in the Old Testament, there was still some of that, as I understood the way this kind of went. But in the New Testament, what we're seeing is it almost limited to an envoy or a messenger, or somebody who's sent on behalf of somebody else, and not somebody that actually provides assistance to you in your walk.
Okay. Understand that when we look at definitions, those definitions are bound up in the culture in which they were written. The definition of a word from a different context is dependent upon the belief structure of the person who's writing down the definition. And at the time that these definitions were written by Strong and Thayer and Mounts, for the most part, the idea that God actually intervened in human affairs had been discounted. So I think it may be true that Strong and Thayer operated in a culture that wouldn't allow them to see that kind of definition.
But in the biblical information, we're going to see.
I think so. As we continue looking at the biblical information, I think we'll see some information that helps us to understand that they, not only are they messengers who bring a message, but they also bring help. Okay. Yeah.
I think it's sort of interesting that a prophet is a mouthpiece of God, but there's a test to make sure that he's saying the right thing. And this messenger, this angel, is coming from God. There's no question that this message is coming from God. There's no secondary concern.
Check and balance.
Yeah, that we'll have to develop that idea. That's an interesting observation, though.
Because, I mean, you know, like with the three angels and Lot, he recognized and that they were going to do something. And he, you know, he tried to dicker with them and get it, whittle it down so that his brethren would be saved. And he managed to do that. But once he knew what was going to happen, it was going to happen. I mean, there's no way he could do anything different.
Yeah. How people judged the veracity of the message that was sent is always interesting to me. Yeah, Ted.
I think about Jesus in the garden when the angel appeared to him, strengthening him. What message could an angel bring to Jesus that he wouldn't already know?
Yeah.
So with that, That angel seemed to serve a very specific purpose that wasn't just bringing this message from God, but just comforting him in some way, strengthening him in some way. So,
as Kim is fond of pointing out, sometimes the best thing you can do is just give somebody a shoulder. And that may be what the angel did when he comforted him. Like Lot's friends came and they comforted him. And when they got there, they didn't say anything. They just sat down with him. And you know, sometimes that's the comfort that we need. But we'll continue. And as we look at more biblical information, we may decide that the definitions that we have are definitions that were placed and that were contextually determined. It's not like these lexicographers operate in a vacuum. Remember, they have to operate in a cultural context, and they assume, based on their cultural context, some things that maybe or maybe not true. So we'll see that as we go on. And that's kind of an interesting lesson for us to learn. Anytime you look at a lexical definition, understand the background against which the lexical definition was written. Because that could have impacted what they were willing to write. Yeah, Mandy.
It's also important that we remember that the lexicographers, while they're living in their culture, mm-hmm. and they're responding to their cultural time period, when the original word was spoken and was used and was written, that's in its own culture.
Yeah.
And so we have to sort of balance all of those pieces together and look at the validity of the word.
Right. Right. So as important as it is to use the lexicons and to use their definitions and to recognize the value of their definitions, don't think that those definitions sort of appeared as if by magic from God. They didn't. They're a product of the culture that developed those definitions. So, yeah, it got kind of confusing there at the end. And if you have questions about that, we can talk about that a little bit more. But we'll continue this next week. And we did a really good job of getting through definitions tonight. That's the first thing that Brent suggests that you need to do is look at some definitions. Thank you for being here. It's a good study. It's something that we need to do, but we never want to lose sight of the fact that what we're trying to understand is how we live for God. And you begin that by putting on Christ in baptism, and then by accepting what he's telling us so that we can live the kind of life that God wants us to live. And we don't always do that. We need to carefully examine ourselves and return to God. God is not going to do anything to take away our free will. He's never done that in the past. Man has always had the freedom to reject what God says, and we don't want to do that. We want to accept what God says, and we want to put it to use in our lives.